Oh, you can sit have the mic.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me today. I will start with an apology. I'm an economist, and what we have heard so far this morning have been very personal stories of the impact of this tragedy in Japan. Economists talk about numbers, not about people. So sometimes the economic perspective can sound a bit cold and uncaring. Bearing that in mind, I would like to offer a few comments on what has happened economically. The typical pattern with a major natural disaster is an initial exaggeration of the negative consequences, followed by a positive upward bounce in the economy brought about by the rebuilding of what was destroyed. I would add, by the way, that as we measure economic activity, we do not measure the destruction. Right? If your house burns down, it is the value of your house is not subtracted from GDP. But the rebuilding of your house adds to GDP. So what we get typically after a natural disaster is the economy starts growing faster. We don't measure the destruction, but we do measure the rebuilding. In the first 12 to 24 hours after the earthquake occurred in Japan, that is what I expected to happen. But the situation became complicated by some things that either surprised me or I just not expected. The first was a rather unusual and unexpected supply chain disruption. The Tohoku area of Japan is not a major manufacturing area for the economy. And so I had assumed that the loss of production would be relatively minor. It turns out, rather unexpectedly, that a number of major Japanese companies, including Toyota Motor Company, happened to have some factories in the Tohoku area that are the only producers of particular parts in their products. And the temporary loss of their output then caused a ripple effect, causing Toyota, for example, to shut down its automobile assembly factories for a period of time. So that was one complication. A second complication is perhaps a longer run issue that we heard a bit about already this morning. At the time of the Kobe earthquake in 1995, there was, in fact, very rapid rebuilding. Kobe is a major city. It's a major port. And so it was rebuilt as it had been. Tohoku is very different. It is largely rural. Is not a major center of population in Japan. And this part of Japan has been losing population. Right, we now have the 2010 census figures for Japan. So these numbers are for before the earthquake. In just the 10 years from 2000 to 2010, Iwate Prefecture lost 4.6% of its population. Miyagi lost 0.7%. And Fukushima lost 5% of its population in 10 years. So this is a region of Japan where the population was already going down. This raises very serious questions. What do we do going forward? Just rebuild? For who? The population shrinking. As we heard already from the students, some people are just drifting away. Right? If the rebuilding doesn't occur fast, people will simply choose to say, now is the time to get out and go live in Tokyo. This is a difficult issue for society to deal with. Obviously, the people who are affected the most are the ones who are still in Tohoku. What do they want? What do young people want? What do old people want? We already heard about that distinction from Ms. Kawakami. These issues are not something for economists to answer, but for the political system to come up with answers. And frankly, that's going to take some time to occur. The third issue that came up was the loss of electric power. I was very surprised by this. The loss of the nuclear power plants in Fukushima was not enough to explain what happened in Tokyo. Right? And what happened was non-nuclear power plants were damaged, not by the tsunami, but by the earthquake. This did not happen in Kobe. There was no major loss of electric power supply at the time of the Kobe earthquake. And I was rather surprised that non-nuclear power plants not located right on the coast were shaken up enough by the earthquake to knock them out of use for several weeks. So the lack of electricity, and as we heard, the uncertainty about whether there would be a blackout was damaging to economic output in the Tokyo area. Tokyo, unlike Tohoku, is a major manufacturing center for Japan, and so that had fairly serious economic consequences for several, at least for the next several weeks. In the longer run, again, there is a political and technological issue raised by the electric power supply issues, and that is, what is Japan going to do going forward? Will you abandon nuclear power? What will you replace it with? And as we all know, that debate is going forward very actively in Japan. All right, so those are the things that complicated the issue. Let me finish with a few comments on what is actually happening. The expected bounce upward in the economy is occurring. After the surprise of a bigger downside impact. So in the first two quarters of the year, the first half of the year, the economy shrank. In fact, in the first quarter of the year, the economy shrank 1.2%. 6.9% at an annualized rate in the first quarter, 1.2% in the second quarter. So the downward movement in the economy was bigger than economists had initially anticipated. But in the third quarter, economic growth was 7%. Or at a 7% annualized rate. This looked entirely typical to me. Electric power supply was coming back. The factories in Tohoku were getting back to work rather quickly. Japanese economy is pretty good at recovering rapidly. So the supply chain problem was eliminated by the end of the summer. To be sure, in the fourth quarter of this year, The economy shrank again, not very fast, but shrank at a 0.7% annualized rate. I'm not really worried about this. Household consumption was growing. Non-residential investment, plant and equipment investment, was growing. In fact, that grew very rapidly and to me suggests a continuation of the rebuilding effort. Residential investment shrank. That probably reflects some of the uncertainty that I mentioned about what to do in Tohoku that has delayed some of the housing reconstruction. And government fixed investment fell, affected both by the uncertainty about what to do and some of the political issues that I think Professor Mochizuki will talk about that may have delayed the decisions to spend more money. Nonetheless, I think that the recovery is well underway in Japan. Longer term, I remain somewhat concerned. I remain somewhat concerned about whether and how quickly decisions will be made concerning what to do in Tohoku. And longer term, of course, we all know that what matters for the Japanese economy is demographics. The population of the whole country is now shrinking. So even as you rebuild, you are rebuilding in the context of an economy that can grow only very slowly, and one in which the population is becoming older, and you will have to deal with that. But those are issues not related to the earthquake, so I don't want to get to talk too much about those. So in conclusion, there was an unexpectedly large blow to the economy, but there is now a rebound occurring, and I think that that will continue for some time. As a final comment, for at least the last 150 years, Japanese society has proven to be well organized, resilient, and very practical. And I think that that will help to get society and the economy through the problem that was created by the triple blow of earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear crisis. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Lincoln. Next, we will have Dr. Mochizuki give his opinions and views on Japanese politics and how the earthquake affected that.
Thank you very much, Kazu. Before I start with my remarks, I want to, on behalf of the Elliott School at George Washington University, welcome all the students from Japan and thank the Knowledge Investment Program for spending so much time with us here today. I found all of the presentations not only informative, but inspirational, and I think I speak for everyone here in our community that we are very glad that you came. One of the things that I just wanted to comment on was the issue about volunteerism. And I, one of the hats that I wear here is the Associate Dean of the Academic Programs at the Elliott School. And I think one of the great aspects of George Washington University is that we're very much of a service-oriented institution, and many of our students are involved in volunteering, participating in non-governmental organizations, setting up volunteer activities, even creating new voluntary activities, not only in the United States, but overseas. And I think it's part of our student culture here. But in addition to that, the university has an Office of Service Learning, and service learning is encouraged and it's very much integrated into our academic curriculum. And so that may be one difference between Japanese universities and what we have here at George Washington University. Now to my remarks about politics. I'm a political scientist and not an economist. Now, although some of us like to be economists and focus on numbers, I think in the end, politics is about people and about leaders. And so some of my remarks will focus on particular individuals and definitely about the people. I want to focus on three different dimensions about politics, and I don't want to get so much into exactly how the political system dealt with the 3/11 earthquake and tsunami, that disaster, because I still think that we don't know exactly what happened, and it's very interesting that there are now a number of reports that have emerged that are beginning to tell the story. And so I would be remiss if I were to claim that this is exactly how the government operated. But I think the earthquake has implications for three very important dimensions of politics. One is the relationship between politicians and bureaucrats. Second is the relationship between the national government and local government. And third is the implication for party politics. First, in terms of the implications for the relationship between politicians and bureaucrats. When I began my studies in Japanese politics, we were often told by professors about how Japan has an elite civil service, that bureaucrats are the best and the brightest. They work long hours for the national interest for very little pay, and then maybe at the end of their career, they're rewarded for their service by descending from heaven into a nice cushy job through Amakudari. But really, it was the bureaucrats that led Japan and not the politicians. But in the course of my academic career, this image of bureaucrats began to fall apart as news about various scandals of these elite bureaucrats began to appear, some in the welfare ministry, some even in the Ministry of Finance. And over time, and especially by the beginning of the 1990s, it became good politics to criticize the bureaucracy, to argue, to argue against the bureaucracy. It was not only in the media, but also new political parties began to emerge criticizing the bureaucracy and the need for political leadership over bureaucrats. And I think one of the factors behind the rise of the Democratic Party of Japan is that many of their leaders ran on the platform that when they came into power, they would control the bureaucrats. Now, as we know, rather than controlling the bureaucrats, initially it became a very antagonistic relationship between politicians and bureaucrats, and this led to many dysfunctions in the new Democratic Party government. And this was clear in the way the government handled the Futenma issue on Okinawa. It was clear in the way the government mismanaged the fishing boat collision near the Senkaku Islands. Now the question is, did this have much of an impact on the way the government dealt with 3/11. Ultimately, Prime Minister Khan was driven out of office because of sharp criticisms about the way he managed this crisis. But I think there's also another view out there. Of course, he's been criticized for micromanaging the post-catastrophe policy. I mean, he tends to meddle into the details. But now it's become apparent that perhaps he was the right person at the right time, because he became somewhat of a folk hero in Japanese politics because of the way he leaned very hard on the Ministry of Health and Welfare over the scandal regarding tainted blood. And there are reports that there were efforts or ideas or the possibility of abandoning the Fukushima nuclear power plant. And it was really because of the firm intervention of Prime Minister Khan that a much greater nuclear disaster was averted. So there might be some positive aspect to the kind of antagonistic relationship that the Democratic Party developed over the bureaucracy. Now there's discussion again about creating a National Security Council similar to that of the United States as a way for the political leadership to have greater control and management over government responses to crises. That may be a good thing, but you know, I would remind people that the United States has a National Security Council, and many times it has not functioned very well, and sometimes it has been dysfunctional, like when the United States got involved in the war in Iraq. So I don't see a National Security Council as necessarily a panacea for this problem. The second issue is about the relationship between the national government and local governments. And this, again, has been an issue that emerged during the 1980s and really became a front burner issue during the 1990s. And this was a notion that it is time to give greater autonomy and greater control over revenues by the localities. The current centralized system doesn't meet the needs of localities, stifles initiative, and maintains a corrupt political structure in which national politicians distribute national revenue to localities, and they're able to skim off the top some brokerage fee known as political contributions. Again, the Democratic Party of Japan ran on a platform of devolving power. Now, how has the March 11th catastrophe affected this debate? Again, it's hard to say. On the one hand, there's probably a move towards greater centralization. Prime Minister Noda has established a reconstruction agency in the national government, which is kind of a super cabinet level post to control the other ministries so that the reconstruction efforts can be managed. Now, this strikes me as an effort at re-centralization. But there are a couple of moves I think that we should watch. One is that what's amazing is how much other local governments have gotten involved in the reconstruction efforts in Tohoku, Japan. You know, one of my best friends wrote a book about extra-local linkages in Japanese regional politics, but you know, that seems to be happening again related to the March 11th disaster. One other thing that we should keep an eye on is what's happening not in Tohoku, but what's happening in Osaka with Mayor Toru Hashimoto and the Osaka Ishin no Kai, the Osaka Restoration Association. And he is using kind of the paralysis of national politics to put forth a pretty radical vision that includes a radical devolution of power to localities. And part of this is a resurrection of this notion of doshisei, which is to amalgamate various local governments into regional entities, about 8 or 9 regional entities, and there will be greater initiative given to those regional entities. And whether or not this would apply to the Tohoku region, I don't know. But this has a possibility of transforming Japanese politics. Finally, about party politics. Since 1990, we've seen a move towards a two-party system. And in many ways, this is a good thing because it clarifies choices for Japanese voters. But Japan has not moved to a pure two-party system. And in fact, what we've seen over this last several years is a proliferation of many parties because politicians have been dissatisfied with the two current parties. I can't remember all of these many parties, but you know what's interesting is, as faulty as the Democratic Party of Japan has been, the Liberal Democratic Party has not been able to capitalize on the mistakes of the DPJ. And so it seems that people are crying out for another alternative, but it's not clear that any of these many parties will capture the attention of the Japanese public. And here again, the Osaka Ishin no Kai has gotten a lot of press. Mr. Hashimoto is using populism to try to create an alternative. And I think this month he has inaugurated a school to recruit students so that they can run for the next national election. Some of you may even be applying to that school. So we are entering a period of great political uncertainty in Japan. It's quite possible that we would have a general election this fall. But what I fear is that there will not be a decisive choice so that you have a strong government. But what you might have instead is that no political party wins a majority. So not only on top of the Nejide Kokai, the twisted diet that we have, we may have to have true coalition politics even in the lower house, which could mean, again, a prolonged period of political paralysis in Japan. So I'll end with this message that in the end, I think volunteering for the reconstruction of Tohoku is very important. But I also think that the Japanese people should take ownership of their politics, that Japanese young people should get involved in politics to participate. Because ultimately, a country gets the government that the people deserve. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Mochizuki, and thank you for translating all the Japanese terms that you've used. And so next, we have Ms. Chama Avery from the CRS, and she will be discussing on the foreign policy implications, particularly on Operation Coconut.
Thank you very much. Before I start, I'm obligated to say that I'm here representing my own views, not the views of the Congressional Research Service, certainly not the views of any of the 535 members of Congress, just here in my own capacity. And I will echo what Dr. Lincoln said, in that after listening to this touching testimony from the students that came here, it feels like my presentation is a little bit clinical and removed. Mostly that's because that's my job at CRS, is to be sort of nonpartisan and neutral. But speaking personally, it was a really sort of an emotionally wrenching thing to cover. I mean, firstly, just because of, you know, these apocalyptic images that were coming out of Japan, and because I live there and care about Japan and was, you know, definitely a flurry of trying to get in touch with all my friends over there, who are mostly from the Tokyo and Osaka areas, so I'm not in the direct line of contact. But it was a very intense experience to be covering this for Congress and tracking what was going on, particularly with Operation Tomodachi, but obviously feeling the emotional impact of it as well. I also just wanted to reflect on one of the presentations about the social media and how that changed interaction after the earthquake there. And it was very interesting because this is the first thing that I have covered for Congress where I was using social media a lot. You know, turns out like the Seventh Fleet has a Facebook page that is was updated really frequently, and you know the Pacific Command has a Twitter feed, and literally that's where you could get the best information on what was happening, what ships were moving where, and it was it's very funny because if you've seen a CRS report, they tend to be very sort of formal, structured affairs, and I was having footnotes that went to Twitter feeds, you know, which I think may have raised some eyebrows in the review office. Mostly I'm going to focus on the U.S.-Japan relationship and talk about the context in which 3/11 occurred in terms of bilateral relations, Operation Tomodachi itself, the moves that came after that, and then a little bit of thoughts on what lie ahead. I think that ultimately, this tragedy turned out to really to strengthen the relationship and even restore it because it had had some rocky patches earlier on. And it did that because the alliance particularly really was able to demonstrate the full benefit of having this deep relationship. And the alliance, of course, has been a source of friction at times in the relationship, but it was really quite a show that the two militaries were able to work together to ultimately, I think, save a lot of lives. It also, of course, went beyond just the security relationship. It generated a tremendous amount of goodwill. And we see that now, even in public opinion polls now, that positive impressions of the United States among the Japanese are somewhere up near 85% or something, and probably in the 70s. On the reverse side of that, Americans looking at Japan, and those are some pretty remarkable numbers. So I think that really contributed that operation contributed to an uptick in the bilateral relationship. Let's talk a little bit about the context in which 3/11 occurred. Relations between Tokyo and Washington at that time were stable, but were sort of regaining their footing after having a bit of a confrontation. When the DPJ government came into power and the Obama administration came into power here, they really faced this standoff over this controversial Marine Air Base in Okinawa. And although this issue had been going on for a long time and had failed, the LDP, of course, had failed to really resolve the issue as well, this became a very public rift between the two governments. And contributed to some drift that I think it started in the later years of the Bush administration. And this was despite the fact that in other ways the relationship was fundamentally strong. I mean, Hillary Clinton's first trip to Secretary of State was to Japan. The first visitor to the White House was Prime Minister Aso. But they sort of couldn't get beyond this military real estate issue, essentially, in Okinawa. And that was based on some campaign promises during the DPJ's campaign. And then sort of divided cabinet, mixed signals from Tokyo, and then some general mishandling probably on both sides. Also, initially, the DPJ indicated that they may pursue a more Asia-centric foreign policy, which some analysts read as leaning more towards China and perhaps away from what traditionally had been, you know, the primacy of the relationship with Washington. But then a series of security developments in the region, I think, sort of set the relationship back on track in some ways. Whenever there are problems in the U.S.-Japan relationship, you can usually count on North Korea to do something crazy and to drive us back together. And sure enough, in 2010, there were some provocations from North Korea sinking the Chunan ship and the shelling of a Waipio island in South Korea. And that helped to forge a little bit more of a consensus. Unity on the six-party talks also contributed to the sense that the relationship was on stronger footing. And then, of course, there was the collision between the fishing vessel and the Coast Guard ship in the Senkakus, which led to some strong affirmations from Washington of the importance of the alliance and the U.S. Commitment to defend Japan. So I think that all of these statements help sort of reset the relationship a little bit. When the March 11th disaster occurred. after the disaster occurred, the U.S. reaction was very swift and very substantial, from the very highest levels with pronouncements by President Obama, a whole parade of cabinet officials going to the Japanese embassy here in Washington to sign the condolence book, and a real strong and full-throated commitment to help Japan recover. In terms of the numbers, the U.S. Committed ultimately over $95 million in assistance, the vast majority, about $88 million, coming from the Department of Defense for the military operations there. But of course, this also trickled down to an outpouring of support from the public here and private donations, and groups, student groups here working on fundraising in a way that I think people found very touching here. Speaking about Operation Tomodachi itself, this was really an unprecedented bilateral effort here. The self-defense forces performed spectacularly well. I mean, their mobilization of 100,000 troops and getting them to the field as fast as they did was very impressive to all who have followed these security events. And a whole separate interesting conversation would be about how the image of the military and the self-defense forces has sort of changed at all because of this within Japan as well. The U.S. contributed thousands of military personnel to the effort, hundreds of aircraft and ships. The way that the two militaries worked together, I think, was very impressive. Again, it was this odd sensation of sort of being shocked and horrified at the images that you were seeing, and then the loss of life and the grief, and also sort of blown away and impressed by how these two militaries were working together to do what they could to provide humanitarian assistance. The expeditionary capability of the U.S. military was particularly helpful in reaching survivors, and we saw some unprecedented efforts where SDF helicopters were using a U.S. aircraft carrier to take off and land. U.S. vessels were transporting SDF personnel as well as equipment up to the site. There were liaison officers from both sides on the other team's ships, and it was just impressive to see the logistics coordination that went on between these two militaries. One of the key aspects here was the reopening of the Sendai Airport, so that could be a sort of a forward operating base and a place to receive humanitarian supplies, and that happened just amazingly quickly. It was a team of 250 Marines or something working side by side with the SDF, and Sendai Airport was under, you know, 8 feet of water or something, even several days after the tsunami, so to be able to clear that wreckage and get relief to those who needed it was quite impressive. Now, this ability to work together like that, of course, is a result of years of training together, of the interoperability of assets, particularly naval assets there, but also, just less tangibly, of trust between the two militaries. Because they had worked together, because the U.S. had had a presence in Japan for a long time, I think they were able to function that way. And this is in marked contrast, by the way, to the Japanese government's reaction after the earthquake in Kobe in 1995, where there was really some, I think mostly a resistance to accepting outside help, despite offers at that time. There now, not just now, but in the months since, many people trying to take stock of the lessons learned from Operation Tomodachi. And a lot of thought, if you're into the security world, of how well this translates into cooperating together in a possible future wartime contingency. And there are many that argue that this is, you know, in some ways as close as you get. I mean, these were two militaries communicating with each other, as well as the air, sea, and land, the branches of the military working together. Uncertain conditions, rapid response. I heard one general say, you know, this sort of exercises all the major muscle groups for sort of a war fighting scenario. Those who are not necessarily skeptical but say we need to work harder on this point out that the communications would need to be improved if you're ever working in a situation where you have an adversary, for example, that a lot of the communication was, you know, done on cell phones because there was no need to keep this information quite a secret. But it was, by all accounts, a very impressive response. And there's talk now, too, of using this sort of as a model and as some sort of a platform for broader regional cooperation on humanitarian assistance and disaster relief operations. I think that the success of Operation Tomodachi, by most accounts, generated quite a bit of momentum for the alliance. There was a 2+2 meeting, Security Consultative Committee meeting, held in June of last year, which was the first time that the meeting had been held with the DPJ government, and the first in 4 years. And that was important simply for getting, you know, the DPJ on board in an official capacity in their commitment to the alliance, a reaffirmation of common security objectives, and also some more concrete results in terms of arranging for some flexibility on Japan's arms export ban, formalizing a commitment to doing some trilateral operations with other countries. So a lot of analysts, although there was still this huge Futenma issue sitting out there, which still remains unresolved to this day, felt that this was the strong signaling that the alliance was getting somewhat back on track after stumbling a bit. There's also the National Defense Program guidelines were delayed by over a year after the DPJ government came into power, but ultimately, again, sort of asserted this new government's commitment to the centrality of the U.S.-Japan alliance in their security outlook. I'm not going to talk at length about the Futenma issue because it tends to suck up all of the oxygen in the relationship, and it would be much too long of a tangent. It's certainly a challenge to the relationship that's going to remain. I think that the last announcement that we had that indicated some degree of flexibility on the part of both the governments was at least a positive sign, and positive in that it's not crowding out all of the other issues in the relationship, but still something that lies ahead that's a major challenge to figure out where a relationship is. In terms of other foreign policy initiatives, I think that the U.S. and Japan have really remarkably broad alignment on a lot of these issues. You've probably heard about the so-called U.S. pivot to the Pacific, or the administration prefers the rebalancing towards Asia nomenclature. And I think this is a strong thing for the U.S.-Japan relationship. There have been some, you know, rumblings from commentators that this just means the U.S. is focusing on Southeast Asia. And I don't think that's true at all. I think that our really strong fundamental alliances in Northeast Asia are going to become all the more important as the U.S. tries to sustain and even increase its diplomatic presence in the region. And I think that the U.S. successful engagement with Southeast Asia has also been a positive thing for Japan, that Japan has supported. We're now seeing a really dramatic possible opening in Burma, and Japan seems to be on really the same page. And this also extends to many other fields. Prime Minister Noda's indication that Japan may be considering negotiations in the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is something that was cheered by many here. I think there's promise and possibly some peril in that, and I can talk about that from the congressional perspective if you'd like me to. But even going to international climate negotiations, however frustrating those have been, the U.S. and Japan tend to be really drawing from the same playbook and supporting each other in those negotiations. So I think that just to wrap it up, given the political conditions that we've seen in Tokyo that Dr. Mochizuki spoke about, I think there's actually sort of remarkable stability in the bilateral relationship, considering that. I mean, there are certainly constraints on the relationship because of that. It's hard to have long-term strategic planning when you don't know who's going to be in office in a couple of months. But I think that other alliance managers and those who tend to the relationship have done a good job of keeping it on track. I think that the biggest risks now going forward is the Okinawa issue that I mentioned. I think if TPP negotiations falter, particularly because of resistance to some reforms in Japan, I think that's a bit of a challenge and a risk to their relationship. But probably in some ways, the more existential danger is this sense that Japan may still sort of turn inward as a result of this disaster. And there's a lot of consternation among those who watch Japan and care about the U.S.-Japan relationship that Japanese may be withdrawing from the world rather than stepping up engagement. But I hope that events like this today and having all of these students come all the way from Japan to talk with students here is an indication that maybe the next generation thinks that it is important to continue that engagement. Thank you very much.
Now we have about 15 minutes for questions for the panelists. So if you have a question, please raise it. Okay, sir, right here. And please wait for the mic. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Horia.
Please wait for the mic. And if you can introduce yourself and your affiliation.
I'm Dan Tiki, I'm one of the top university, the key member. Thank you for your oral speech. And I have a question for Professor Mochizuki. And in your speech, you mentioned that the Japanese youth should involve in the politics. But have you ever thought about the real media and the system to establish to achieve the goal? And what the adults hope for the youth to achieve the goal?
Thank you very much, Ikeda-san, for that question. Of course, you can wait for a system to emerge that you can participate in. But in this period of uncertainty, there's also an opportunity to help to remake the system. I remember when in 1993, when the Liberal Democratic Party split, people talked about the end of the 1955 system. And some thought that there was a new system that had emerged. But I talk about it as this long political transition that we're still transitioning to something. And so, in a sense, this is a great opportunity for young people to think about what kind of political system Japan ought to have, and opportunities for creative ideas. So rather than just being passive and selecting from an existing menu of choices, are you going to support the LDP, the DPJ, or the Tachiagare Nippon party? Maybe what you need to think about is what kind of political system Japan ought to have, and you can work towards that. Ultimately, Japan is a democratic country, and you can help shape the politics. So don't be passive, be proactive.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir, in the back.
Hi, I'm a freshman from George Washington University. I have two questions. One for Professor Mochizuki. As far as I know, farming is a very important aspect for the whole Japanese politics, because farming, although it has very low portion of the whole population in Japan, whereas a huge important role for the whole political aspect in Japan. Would this like accidental pollution after these, the nuclear power plant, like this accidental pollution for the like to what extent does the change of the political opinion of those farmers will change the whole political aspect of Japan? This is my first question. And my second question is for the Professor Lincoln, is do you think the disaster will be an incentive for the Japanese government to enhance the new policy in order to recruit more foreign immigrants? As you say, there is a shrinking population in Japan. So do you think it will enhance more foreign immigrants outside to Japan? Thank you.
Thank you very much for that question about farming. I am a strong supporter of Japanese farming. I disagree with many of my colleagues who sometimes believe that Japan should get out of the farming business because of lack of comparative advantage. But I do believe that the current agricultural system doesn't make it possible for the farming sector to revitalize. And so what you really need is major reform of agricultural policy so that you know, there could be some consolidation of farming so that young people might want to get into farming. You know, I think that the American style of agribusiness has many problems with it, Japan should be cautious when they think about trade negotiations and the implications that it has for the farming sector. This, of course, has major implications for places like Fukushima, which has been a major farming area. And I think this is one of the great tragedies of this accident of the power plant, because we still don't know what the long-term effects of the farming and fishing sector will be in that part of Japan. But I think it's imperative that the government work with the farming community to change its farming policies so that Japanese agriculture can revitalize.
On the immigration issue, I'm not sure that the March 11th events and the response to that will have much impact one way or the other, except perhaps in a negative way. I think the government and society are so absorbed with the shorter run issue of how to respond to the situation in Tohoku that the longer term issue of shrinking population, aging population, and the role of immigrants has been kind of pushed to the side for a while. Other than that, yeah, you know, this is a really big issue that Japanese society will have to confront over the next 10 to 20 years. And I think it will be a very difficult issue for Japanese society to come to grips with. Good luck working that.
All right, next set of questions, please. Yes, sir.
Thank you for lectures. My name is Ken Yasaka. I'm a student of Tokyo University, the Faculty of Medicine. And I have two questions. One is for Dr. Rinka, and the other is for Dr. Azuka Mochizuki. And one is that, as the Dr. Rinka mentioned, that it's important not to rebuild as it rebuild as it was, but also to recreate new area in Tohoku. I think I agree with that, but I'm afraid that it might lead to something like shock doctrine. And, you know, for example, the the acceptance of immigrants, which is necessary, I think, but it's getting back to the destruction of communities or the conflicts between immigrants' communities and the local communities. So what do you think is the most important point to balance between the reconstruction and rebuilding as it was? And the other question is for Dr. Mochizuki. After the crisis of Fukushima, in the press conference, the cabinet secretary Adam Ikio mostly was appearing in the press conference and answering questions. But do you think it was good? Because the secretary was not a scientist, so he does not have enough scientific knowledge or wisdom. So people were a little bit confused, or you know, couldn't believe the government announcements.
Yeah, Ms. Chan, Adrian, if you want to chime in, please feel free to do so.
Let me just start quickly with this question of how to rebuild. The issue is to figure out what sustains or what will sustain the people in that part of Japan, both economically and, as you mentioned, socially. What kind of community do you want to have? But then they have to earn some money, right? So what is it that's going to sustain that region going forward? One would have thought, for example, that if agriculture is in decline, particularly as Professor Mochizuki says, under the current set of agricultural policies, what else can you do? Well, maybe tourism. But maybe that doesn't work because tourists don't want to go to Fukushima at the present time. So it's a difficult issue to work out. How you fit immigrants into it is also an issue. You mentioned holding communities together. One of the things that surprised me in the aftermath of the tsunami was the Chinese government came in to help Chinese workers go back to China. Because with the decline of young people in Tohoku, who was working in the fish processing plants? Chinese. Not immigrants, they're temporary workers. They were, there's a whole program for trainees, so they come for 2 years and go home. And there were, at the minimum, there were hundreds of these people. Some of them died. I didn't know they were there. You probably didn't know they were there. So something was happening in these communities, right? That there were not enough people to be employed in these factories. Foreigners were coming in anyway. But again, that's something to think about going forward.
On Chief Cabinet Secretary Edano, I subscribe to NHK television here, and I watch daily the press briefings that Mr. Edano gave, and I admired him for his clarity and how stable he seemed to be in a very difficult situation. I understand your point. You know, did he have the expertise to be giving kind of very complicated engineering and scientific information? He was speaking on behalf of the government, whether there should have been a science advisor there with him. To field questions that might have given more accurate and information about what was going on. But in hindsight, I think the issue and where there might some debate is, did Mr. Edano kind of downplay the seriousness of the nuclear disaster? And it seems that he probably did. And the reasoning was probably that he didn't want the Japanese people to panic. But was that the right call? So it's not just a matter of kind of his scientific expertise, but should, in a disaster situation such as this, which was unprecedented, how much should the Japanese government talk about really bad scenarios that could happen? And you know, if you knew then that Prime Minister Kan was contemplating the evacuation of Tokyo, what kind of response could have been triggered in Japan? Now, I did, when I watched the programming, there were a number of scientists who appeared, Japanese scientists. And the way they explained the situation was very different from the way American scientists appeared on CNN. In America, it was very, very alarmist. The Japanese scientists spoke in very kind of measured fashion. But when you listen to what they were saying, it was just as alarming as what I was hearing on CNN. And so, you know, there might have been a disconnect between Mr. Edano saying things are under control, downplaying it, and then a moment later you will listen to a scientist and things weren't under control. That was said in a very sober fashion. But you know, I felt when I listened to that, the situation seemed quite alarming.
And time for one more question. I'd like to ask you to keep it short and only one question, please. Yes.
Thank you.
I'm
Sarah My name is Alejandra. I'm a first-year student here at the Elliott School in the International Development Studies. And my question is for Ms. Charlotte Abbott. I was wondering, you mentioned that there was excellent coordination between the U.S. military and the Japanese military. And I'm just curious, is it because they had already been collaborating together, or is there a possibility for militaries to have that sort of training to react to humanitarian disasters, you know, anywhere that could happen? Or, you know, was this like because it had already been, because the two armies worked together? Or, I didn't understand that. Thank you.
I don't think it's an either or situation. I do think that the coordination that we saw on display in response to the disaster was particularly strong because the two militaries had trained together and exercised together for many, many years, and also simply because the U.S. had assets in place there. I mean, we have, you know, thousands of troops based there, very sophisticated equipment, and we're able to divert other assets, including a whole carrier task force group, to come to the area that were elsewhere in Asia. So simply, you know, geographical proximity obviously makes a huge difference. But that doesn't mean that you can't, based on this model and the kind of cooperation you see there, expand it to other humanitarian assistance disaster relief operations, particularly with other militaries in the region. And this is often spoken of as a way to broaden defense cooperation because it's non-political, you know, it's humanitarian. We saw some of this in response to the massive tsunami in the Indian Ocean and the use of U.S. military equipment as well as many other militaries' response mechanisms at work there. But I think that the degree of interoperability that we saw here is somewhat difficult to duplicate.
Well, thank you so much, panelists. Please give them another round of applause. So for the next section of the event, we will be splitting into four different discussion groups. I think you were all assigned numbers indicating which group you will be in. Dr. Lincoln, Dr. Mochizuki will be at each group through the time. Now, if I may briefly remind everybody, if you can keep these themes into mind, what are the possibilities and what are the challenges that came out of March 11th? And as the panelists explained, there are a variety of foreign policy, domestic, political, and economic challenges that Japan faces in the future. But how can American students and Japanese students that will be leading respective countries work together in the future? And if you can also consider the presentations that our brilliant knowledge investment program students gave today in your conversations, that'll be terrific. So I guess we'll have group one here, group two here in the front, group three in the back over there, and group four in the back on in the left. So let's enjoy our conversation. You can rearrange the chairs in circles. So.
Right, but basically, there were